happen. Let's get legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Mike Leonard, Leonard Trial Lawyers, joins us now till the end of the show. Hey, Mike, how you doing, bud?
Hey, John, how's it going? Good to be with you.
It's a gorgeous day outside in Chicago, and we're chatting about all sorts of things. Law, what could be better?
Perfect, perfect day. And who doesn't want to sit inside and listen to us, John, talk about law? What better way to spend an afternoon, correct?
Maybe some people are mowing the lawn. They got us on the app, and they're listening in the headphones, or they're going for a walk. They can enjoy the outside while still get some from legal pointers from our great experts like you, including this one I wanted to ask you, Mike. And I thought it was a great question. I do want to get into the Jordan Neely case, but I want to do that after the news so we have some time to really dive in. You are getting asked this a lot by people. Should I go to law school? Not me, John Hansen, although I know a lot of people think I should. Well, you've told me I should. But what do you say to people that are considering law as a profession right now?
Are you sure, John, you're not really asking that just so we can get some insight here?
I have thought about it, and it's not just since I started hosting the show. It was something I really considered after my undergrad.
That,
but... Go ahead.
I think you would love it, actually. But, yeah, it comes up a lot for some reason. I think it's because... You know, I got a couple of kids college age, so we know a lot of people in that age group, right? And so that subject comes up very often. Like, you know, what am I doing next? Do you think this is a good idea to go to law school? And from my standpoint, I say, yeah, I think it's a great idea if you have that passion, you know, if you have that drive, it's something you really want to do. Of course, I think you should seriously consider it. You know, there's huge factors involved. You know, one is, you know, do you have the passion you really want to do it? Is there an area of law that really interests you? The interesting thing about the law is there's 50 different things you could go into. You know, you could decide you have want nothing to do with being a trial lawyer or doing anything that I do, but there's 50 other things that you could do and really enjoy. And then, of course, though, there's the giant economic question, you know, because it's quite costly. So I always say if you definitely have the passion for it, that's really where you see yourself, absolutely. And then, of course, there's a question about financing it. But I think it's a fantastic training ground for almost anything. But people can't afford it anymore just as a training ground to do other things, I don't think.
Right. It can't just be I'm going to go for 3 more years, get this for the hay of it, no matter what I end up going into. You better end up working in law, most likely, to get to pay off those loans. By the way, Mike, the 708 texted us. Some people are delivering the mail and listening to WGN. Well, thank you very much for delivering our mail.
Right.
We appreciate that.
The U.S. Postal Service on our side. Yeah, a couple other twists on the law school thing.
Uh-huh.
So one of the interesting issues people have been talking about, at least in legal publications, is, you know, what is the effect of AI upon the law?
Oh, yeah.
And what is it going to mean for law firms? One of the things that people are saying already is that it's going to have a really large impact upon the younger lawyers, you know, because, as you might know, you know, some of those early years, and again, there's such a vast disparity of the size of law firm you work at. You know, some people go to these mega law firms that have 1,000 lawyers, and other people go to a law firm that has 1 or 2 people. So that will dictate a very different experience. But for the large law firms that do a lot of hiring on a yearly basis, you know, sometimes in those early years, you can do things like document review and things like that, which are not sexy and not necessarily a lot of fun, but are integral to cases. But the theory is that a lot of that stuff is already being, you know, made, I don't know what the right word is, but I guess outsourced and possibly obsolete, because you can use so many techniques now to review documents and do things of that nature. And with AI, the theory is it's going to even be much, you know, more efficient and cleaner to eliminate a lot of those tasks that are sort of routine and repetitive. So there is this fear that'll cause younger lawyers to have a more difficult time getting jobs or to get their hours in, all those sorts of concerns. But, you know, it's kind of the AI threat is everywhere, I think.
Yeah,
so it's hard to say yet what it's going to mean for the law.
Whether it's law or anything else, I would say to anyone out there, start playing with ChatGPT, start learning how the AI can make you better at your job, because I don't think it's going to eliminate a ton of jobs. I think it's going to eliminate jobs from people who aren't willing to embrace the technology. So I think a lawyer who knows ChatGPT is going to be more employable than a lawyer who doesn't. Would you agree with that, Mike?
Yeah, the only downside I can see, which is not necessarily a downside for clients, is probably a huge upside and a huge efficiency and a huge cost savings. But some of the things that you took a lot of labor intensive, like reviewing documents, analyzing documents, things of that nature, because in any litigation case, there may be anywhere from just a few hundred documents to millions, right? So that's going to change things dramatically over time. I think it's already changed the way we review documents and process information, but you could argue that some tasks are going to be maybe lesser valued or obsolete, which, you know, could certainly still have an impact upon lawyers' employability and all those sorts of issues that accompany that.
For sure. More with Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers. Mike, what phone number can people reach you at, by the way?
312-380-6559.
Okay. And you can call us, 312-981-7200. Mike is great for grab bag questions about the law. You got anything you're wondering about the law? Mike is usually the guy to ask. Anything you're afraid to ask because it might seem like a dumb question? No such thing. Bring it up here, 312-981-7200. We'll filter all your calls and take them for Mike Leonard. We'll chat about more after this on WGN. Time for the news. John Hansen here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. So many legal stories in the news today, it's hard to keep track of them. One we haven't talked about on this program yet, Mike, and honestly, it's just such a heartbreaking story. It's been really, I've been kind of staying away from it a little bit, and you know, that's not my... maybe the best thing to do as a host of a legal show, but the death of Jordan Neely in New York was just so, it was there in front of everybody, right? And he was, for those that don't know or don't remember, he was placed in a chokehold by another passenger. It was ruled a homicide, and that man has been arrested. What has he been charged with, Mike?
So he was charged under New York law with second degree manslaughter, which means that it's essentially reckless conduct that caused the death of another. So it's not, you know, premeditated murder or anything like that, but second-degree manslaughter. So it's just, I'm sure he was reckless in his actions. And just so the listeners are clear, the facts were that, you know, a gentleman was on the New York subway who was apparently homeless and may have had some criminal history, but sounds like it was a minor criminal history. And there's a really troubling video. But apparently the actions that led to that were, the individual who later becomes the victim, who's the homeless person on the subway, is shouting at some passengers, may have thrown a jacket at somebody. And then the individual who's now the defendant, who's a former Marine, puts him in a chokehold, but there's some assistance from other passengers, and he holds on to him for so long that the guy dies.
Yeah.
And so the charge was, after much consideration, second-degree manslaughter, and of course the defense is going to be self-defense.
And the self-defense is written into state laws, right? I mean, these are state, and state by states have different laws. And I know we went through a very high-profile self-defense case just a few, you know, hours north of here in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And what does one have to prove in New York that you were acting in self-defense? Have you kind of looked up the differences in that state versus others?
Yeah, and it's pretty similar. I mean, there's similar elements everywhere, but he's going to have to show is that he was acting in the defense of himself or others, and he has to show that there was a threat, right, to the bodily harm, integrity of others, or himself. But the key factual question is going to be, you know, and this is kind of the case anywhere when you have a self-defense, were his actions reasonable? Was his force justified? Was his force commensurate with the threat? All
right.
Those factual issues. But I think what's going to make it extremely interesting from a jury standpoint when the case is tried is you have really literally every hot button issue. You have the military involvement, which from jurors often evokes very positive or very negative sympathies, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have the question of, you know, the homelessness and services in New York and the state of the subway system. You got the political issues and racial issues because the victim was black and the individual claiming self-defense was white. So it's really going to put kind of sort of a classic self-defense case. And, you know, what makes it more interesting is I think the background of the individual who's now the defendant, military service and military training, you know, the prosecution's probably going to argue that he knew that what he was doing in terms of a chokehold was dangerous and could cause death and that he shouldn't have done it for so long versus an average citizen who might not have that training or exposure to that type of move. So I think it really kind of presents all the facets of a sort of a classic self-defense and all the sort of social issues that you might see in any case.
Yeah, it was very well summarized, Mike. For self-defense, like, you can't just put someone in a chokehold that might kill them because they're yelling at people on the subway. I mean, that is annoying and a nuisance, and maybe it was more threatening and the language was more threatening. And I'm sure that we're going to hear two different sides of the story, right, about what happened and what led up to it. But at least in New York, the way I understand it is, I mean, it has to the scale has to be even. The defense that you're using against someone has to have been matched in some way by the threat that they pose to you.
Well, yeah, that's a good point, John. It's very similar to Illinois, or probably the same, meaning that just because someone's making noise on the subway or annoying people or even maybe getting in people's face, there has to be some sort of physical threat to them, to their safety. So, like you said, it's going to be key to break down what exactly happened. And I think one thing that's going to help the defendant, maybe, is that you have these other people who jumped in who were also involved in holding this person. And clearly, I think they're going to testify, you would think, that there was a threat sufficient that they all thought that bodily restraining him was needed, right? But just because they did it too doesn't mean that the force was justified in this case. And you're right. I mean, just because someone's yelling at you or shouting, your response has to be commensurate with the threat. And so one of the initial questions will be, was there really even a threat to anybody? And so we don't have all the video feed from that. And so that's going to be real fact-dependent based upon all those witnesses who were in that subway car on that particular day at that particular time.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting here, and someone pointed this out, and I think we all agree that no one, like, deserves to die, of course. So I just want to preface that. The texter wanted to know. He was known to be a dangerous person who has a history of hurting others. I've read that he has been arrested a couple times, including for assaults on subway riders. Can that be used by the defense? Because, like, wouldn't it matter that the defendant knew that, like, and would factor that into the decision of the chokehold? Like, if the defendant didn't know that, can the defense use that as an argument?
John, you continue to make the argument for yourself going to law school. you're already halfway there.
Okay.
You know, those are really good points because from the defense standpoint, they're going to want to get in evidence of his prior bad acts, okay? However, you're right in the sense that if the people on the subway, particularly the defendant, had no idea that this guy had ever done anything wrong or ever posed a threat to anybody else, they're going to be hard-pressed to get the judge to admit that evidence because it's the reasonableness of the defendant and what he knew at the time, right, and what the threat was on that particular occasion. So, you know, it's going to be a pretrial battle in terms of what are called motions in limine in terms of what evidence is going to be admitted. You know, the judge could very well find that, well, that's great, he may have some criminal history, he may have done some previous acts, but without the defendant having any knowledge of those previous actions, it's not relevant to his state of mind and the reasonableness and justification of the force that he used on that particular occasion.
Right, like if the defendant had seen him attack a subway rider before and the behavior leading up to what happened on that day was similar, maybe you could say the argument, like, I've seen him do this before, I knew he was going to do it again, that seems relevant, but
yeah, it's interesting.
It's an interesting wrinkle in this, because, you know, maybe he was protecting riders who were about to be attacked, you know, we don't know, and maybe the Jordan Neely's arrest history might show that maybe that was the case. I'm not saying for sure it was, but again, like we're saying, if the defendant himself didn't know that, yeah, that's weird. We could go round and round on this one, Mike, because it's a lot of interesting things going on.
It's kind of interesting to do, and that's the funny thing about this is it's the kind of hypothetical you get in a law school classroom where, you know, they'd pose a set of facts, then they'd add a fact. Well, what if the defendant knew this? You know what I mean? So it's exactly the kind of hypothetical you would see in a law school classroom, and so that's what's going to make this case so interesting. And you know, the facts are going to develop. There's going to be eyewitness testimony from lots of people. Some of whom are probably going to say, no, he was annoying me, he was yelling, but I didn't think he posed any threat. I don't know why those guys did that or why the defendant did that. Others are going to say, yeah, I was in fear of my life, he was threatening me. So it's really going to be a mixed bag in terms of the eyewitness testimony we can probably predict.
Yeah, that's interesting, too, because if other subway riders say, oh, my God, I was scared for my well-being, that's a point for the defense. If other riders were just like, no, it was pretty chill, or, yeah, this stuff happens on the New York subway all the time and I ignore it. I mean, then it's going to come down to, you know, the jury, which side they believe. Anyways, Mike, I want to take a break, or we have to take a break. And then we're going to come back and talk a little more, okay?
Sounds great, Joe.
That's Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers, who is an excellent lawyer in his own right. Glad he went to law school. LeonardTrialLawyers.com. We'll talk more after this on WGN. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We're here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. A couple more minutes here with Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers. I was texting you, Mike, about the case of the Covington and Burling attorney who has acknowledged her role in leaking information about a sexual harassment probe into former CBS chief executive Les Moonves. So this goes back a couple years, and the New York Times was doing a lot of reporting on what was happening. CBS hired Covington and Burling to kind of do an investigation, and this Allison Dirks basically was in doing a document review like you talked about earlier, which is a job young lawyers often do, and she was leaking leaking information just for the CBS folks and for her law firm to know about to the New York Times. I know you weren't able to listen to the whole podcast that I was telling you about, but attorney-client privilege is a pretty ironclad thing that I imagine you would never recommend lawyers break, although you also represent whistleblowers, Mike. So how do you square that circle in this case where someone leaks documents from an internal investigation done by a law firm that they think is righteous and right, but also breaks one of the main tenets of what being a lawyer is all about?
Yeah, well, the key is, you know, what position does the whistleblower hold? You know, so there's a huge difference between an attorney who's involved in the investigation or is privy to parts of the investigation and what their duties are. And they definitely have, you know, higher and more stringent duties just from the fact that they're attorneys and they're regulated by the bar. And so, you know, you can't leak information that is client confidentiality to a third party for sort of purposes of advancing, you know, one of the party's interests. And that's from an attorney perspective. And, you know, even if that was an employee doing the same thing at one of those companies and had information that was confidential and was leaking it, of course, they'd get fired. The attorney, what's going to happen to them is they'll probably get disciplined by their bar.
Oh, they did.
But the other point, John, is, you know, the completely different situation where if you're just a pure whistleblower, and let's take an example that happens all the time. So someone's working for, let's say, a healthcare company, giant healthcare company will be our example, John, our law school hypothetical. And they are becoming a whistleblower because they're going to file a lawsuit, you know, saying that their client, the healthcare company, is bilking the federal government or the state government by submitting false claims, you know, either inflated bills or services not provided or things of that nature, right? And so in that circumstance, the person is working at the company is privy to information that would otherwise be confidential, including some stuff that would be, HIPAA protected, patient information. But the law carves out exceptions for people like that, lets them actually take those documents, give them to an attorney, let the attorney use them for purposes of bringing the whistleblower lawsuit. And the whole idea behind that is if the whistleblower couldn't otherwise, you know, violate HIPAA and couldn't provide these documents to the attorney, there'd be no way to prove and make their case. So, you know, it really, again, depends upon what role the person is playing as a whistleblower. Attorneys have very different duties, and whistleblowers have exceptions to producing and disclosing documents, which are for the greater good of, you know, bringing fraud to light is the theory.
Yeah, this whistleblower or this leaker, Allison Dirks, was fired, obviously, from her job and then was disbarred out of D.C. for, I think, a year and a half. And she's often wondered whether she should maybe go get back her law license. But she's been told that the law firm would appeal that at any stretch of the imagination to prevent that from happening. I just found it a really interesting listen and to hear from her perspective about doing something that she felt was right, which completely destroyed her career. And how she doesn't regret it. It's just an interesting aspect, Mike. I wish we had more time to break this sort of stuff down. Mike, who should be reaching out to you, my friend?
Individuals who face federal criminal charges or state felony charges. And then on the civil side, as we said, people who are whistleblowers who are bringing forth allegations of fraud or abuse on behalf of their companies. They should give you a call, John.
Yeah, what number should they call you at?
312-380-6559. And can I give you 10 seconds about an amazing coincidence about today's show?
Please.
So you had that U.S. Postal Service person call in, and then, you know, I didn't want to say too much, but we currently have one federal case in Chicago, one federal case in Massachusetts representing postal workers. One is accused of misusing expense reports. The other one is accused of having mail that was in their bag after a shift and charged with a federal felony. And in both cases, we deal with that rate. Interesting.
Yeah, they're listening right now. You're breaking up a little bit on us, Mike, but yeah, we had a postal worker text in earlier. Good point there, Mike. All right, LeonardTrialLawyers.com is where you can go for more information.